Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Richard Nixon called for a project independence from imported oil in 1973. Gerald Ford chimed in 1975. Jimmy Carter called the effort the moral equivalent of war. And every president since, down to George W. Bush on America's oil addiction, has sounded the call. And still, the tankers line up from around the world as America consumes a quarter of the Earth's energy supply. This hour On Point, President Obama takes his turn. Last week, speaking about his energy initiative to an audience of students at Georgetown University, President Obama said that many presidents have pledged to wean the country from foreign oil. None have succeeded.
We've known about the dangers of our oil dependence for decades. Richard Nixon talked about freeing ourselves from dependence on foreign oil. And every president since that time has talked about freeing ourselves from dependence on foreign oil. Politicians of every stripe have promised energy independence, but that promise has so far gone unmet.
Unmet by a far stride. Joining me first today from Houston, Texas, is Angel Gonzalez, Houston Bureau Chief for Dow Jones Newswires. Angel, thank you very much for being with us. What's the president's goal that he laid out last week?
Oh, hi, Tom. The main goal that the president laid out last week is to reduce oil imports by one-third, and that would amount to between 3 and 4 million barrels per day of crude, and that's about the amount of production that's coming out of Canada, for example, that's coming out of Mexico.
So we're not talking about energy independence here, but to pull back one-third from 08 levels by 2025, more than a decade from now.
Exactly. And in a way, many people say that's achievable. Many analysts say that's achievable because people expect U.S. oil consumption to remain more or less flat for the next few years because of energy efficiency and engine efficiency gains. And also they foresee a growing role for biofuels. But also, in a way, the unknown part of this plan, I mean, it seems to rely on technological advances that are not there yet in terms of creating biofuels that really can be used massively, and biofuels that do not come from corn or other edible crops. And they're called cellulosic biofuels, and it doesn't seem we're there yet. I mean, they're hoping for a breakthrough to happen.
Everybody's been hoping for a breakthrough for a long time, and we're talking about a cut of a third over almost 15 years, but certainly nothing like energy independence. And Angel, a big part of what the president's put out there, yes, it includes efforts to develop those new technologies, but it also includes some very old-fashioned drilling in this country and quite a bit of it. What's that look like?
Well, there's a lot of oil in this country, and for example, we are at a production peak, and right now I think we are seeing the highest amount of oil produced in the United States in a couple of years. But that will certainly help offset imports at some point. But there's a limit to that because the U.S. has a relatively small amount of reserves compared to the rest of the world.
Nuclear is included here. What is President Obama proposing on the nuclear energy front after the Fukushima Daiichi disaster?
Well, I mean, he's proposing more oversight, but he reiterated that nuclear energy has a place in America's energy future, and a lot of external observers agree with that. I mean, if energy is to be obtained in a more or less carbon-free form, nuclear energy probably has to have a role. But, of course, I mean, the government is very concerned after what happened in Japan.
But he's not just talking a role. He's talking pretty big federal dollars to go in to support nuclear energy even now.
Yes. I mean, indeed. And the thing is, on the one hand, yes, they want to support nuclear energy. On the other hand, they want to make sure it's safe and the end result of that is there's probably going to be a delay in what many people thought would be a nuclear energy renaissance.
Renaissance is not the word on a lot of people's minds as we watch Japan struggle with it, but everybody's looking for energy sources that are not carbon-producing, and nuclear is at least in that camp. We've heard a lot lately about drilling in the Gulf, maybe even British Petroleum, BP, coming back to drill in the Gulf. What do you know on that front, Angel? Is the administration in conversation with BP about pushing more drilling in the Gulf of Mexico after its big blowout and disastrous spill last summer?
Well, the administration is in conversation with every oil company, including BP. The sense that I got after seeing the reactions from the government on the stories that broke out the weekend, saying that the administration was conducting special conversations with BP. I mean, the sense that I got is that these conversations were not exclusive. It's part of the same feedback they are giving every oil company. I mean, that said, BP wants to go back to the Gulf. I think what they are basically what they have in the pipeline is development wells. I mean, those are different from exploration wells. Exploration wells is like the well that blew out in April, killing 11 people. Last April, killing 11 people. These development wells are basically to maintain fields producing that have already been explored and that are already producing and that are already well known. So there's a difference to that, but the U.S. government says that they are not giving BP any kind of special treatment here.
No special treatment, but more drilling central to the president's energy independence plan, or at least down a third plan. And BP officials at BP reported over the weekend saying they're in conversations with the administration about being in on that. Angel Gonzalez with Dow Jones Newswires in Houston. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Here's a little more of the president last week at Georgetown University. His energy program has taken some real lumps. It's had some successes. He's trying to regroup here, talking about drawing down or pulling down the country's dependence on imported oil.
The only way for America's energy supply to be truly secure is by permanently reducing our dependence on oil. We're going to have to find ways to boost our efficiency so we use less oil. We've got to discover and produce cleaner, renewable sources of energy that also produce less carbon pollution, which is threatening our climate. And we've got to do it quickly.
And we've got to do it quickly, but presidents have been calling on the imported oil reduction front for progress for a long time, and more than that. Joining me now from New York City is Michael Gratz. He's a professor at Columbia Law School, professor emeritus at Yale Law. His new book is The End of Energy, The Unmaking of America's Environment, Security, and Independence. You can see an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Michael Gratz, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Good to be with you again.
So here we are. The president had a big vision during his campaign for the White House back in 2008. He's come in, he's made some progress, but he's taken some big lumps on some big planks of that policy. And now he's out with a call that we've heard from president after president after president on reducing imported oil. What did you hear in the president's speech last week, Michael?
Well, I heard echoes, Tom, of what he'd been saying since his 2008 campaign, that he was going to use the government's power to regulate energy efficiency, to purchase electric cars, and to subsidize and incentivize other forms of fuels, including, as Angel mentioned, biofuels, but also other forms of alternative energy. There was nothing really very new in it. It's interesting because he gave a speech immediately after the BP oil disaster from the Oval Office. And once again, he basically repeated things he had said before. He's dropped, of course, any discussion or mention of the now dread words cap and trade from his speeches. You don't hear that anymore. So there's less, not more, than there used to be.
Ezra Klein looked at this and said that Obama's energy policy looks more like Sarah Palin's applause lines than the cap and trade program from the campaign season. He says you can put lipstick on drill, baby, drill, but it's still drill, baby, drill. Is that essentially what Obama's now also saying?
Well, I don't think that's fair to Obama's policies. He's, he's taken an all of the above approach. He's very committed to biofuels. We talked about that a little bit as a substitute for oil, it echoes. You know, Jimmy Carter was determined to produce biofuels from coal. Imagine how much worse off we'd be now if we were running our automobiles on coal.
That's bio in a very ancient sense, bio from and, coal.
Exactly. But, you know, if you ask what are our biofuels today, well, we get about 7% of our gasoline that we fill up our tank with is composed of ethanol. We know that there have been huge subsidies over the years for ethanol. It's driven up food prices. It's lined the pockets of agribusiness and oil companies that now own the ethanol refineries. It's a disaster, but we can't get rid of it. And now one of the alternatives is wood, biofuels from wood. So we'll just increase the price of housing and cut down trees, which soak up carbon. I mean, one of the difficulties is that these decisions about what to incentivize, what to subsidize, have been grounded in politics and not in science.
And I'm joined today by Michael Gratz. His new book is The End of Energy, The Unmaking of America's Environment, Security, and Independence. Michael Gratz, I'm reading here, you're reminding us that we're still waiting for the answer to Jimmy Carter's question somewhat 3 decades ago from the Oval Office, from the White House, talking about a crisis of confidence, that famous speech. He said then, why have we not been able to get together as a nation to resolve our serious energy problem? You take it right back to politics, Michael. Lay it out for us. If the roadblocks are still there, what are they? What have they been?
Well, it's interesting. You know, at the end of the 70s, we thought the problem was presidential leadership. We had first a corrupt president, then an accidental one, and then a politically incompetent president.
Nixon, Ford, Carter.
So we blamed that on them. And then today we say, well, it's a partisan problem. We've got gridlock in Washington. The Republicans and Democrats can't get together. Both of those explanations are wrong. We've had many good presidents since the 70s, and the problems are really deeply regional and much less partisan. So I'll give you one example, okay. Tom. This week, Tom Coburn of Oklahoma proposed getting rid of ethanol subsidies because we know they don't work. Charles Grassley of Iowa, which is a big ethanol-producing state, reminded Coburn that he was from Oklahoma and they had a lot of oil, and he just assumed get rid of the oil subsidies. This is an internecine fight between two conservative Republicans. Liberal Democrats like Jay Rockefeller and others who rely on coal production in their states or cheap coal-based electricity have resisted moving away from coal with all of its health and pollution problems into a cleaner fuel like natural gas to protect their parts of the country. And so we really have short-term political politics that are parochial and regionally based, and Congress can't seem to get together to respond to the national needs and the national interest.
So the silver bullet idea always comes up. You know, it was raised in the 70s. George Bush raised it. Barack Obama and his Energy Secretary Stephen Chu are talking about big investments in finding a way out of this. And everybody wants it. Is that the way to sort of pole vault out of the regional energy interests that are engaged here or not?
Well, I'm very skeptical. I think I think it's very important that we invest in technology and that we have technological change. For Richard Nixon, the technological nirvana was the so-called breeder reactor, a nuclear power plant. For Jimmy Carter, it was Synfuels, as I mentioned earlier. Barack Obama has his list. Everybody has a list. The problem is that we're making these technology decisions, again, based on politics rather than based on science. And what we really need is new institutional arrangements so that we can invest in the appropriate technologies and then help bring these technologies to market. We were way ahead, for example, on solar, Tom, when we were in the 1970s. We put a lot of money into solar research. We were at the cutting edge. In the 80s, oil prices dropped. We lost our attention on energy research. We went to health instead. In 2008, half of the energy research dollars were done through earmarks. We really need a better system. There are some improvements that have been made recently in terms of deciding who gets this money. But, you know, you've got this huge pork barrel throwing money out at all sorts of things, and they don't work.
Well, I'm hearing two things there, Michael. You're saying, you know, we've invested, need to invest and then help bring things to market, but also that it's a pork barrel wasted on a lot of subsidies. So how do you decide if it's going to be a wasteful subsidy or a useful subsidy? How do you draw the line through that?
Well, I think we need to have scientists rather than politicians deciding what the best prospects are for investment. And the problem is that we give tax credits for one thing after another, which are decided based, again, on regional politics. There was, for example, a subsidy, again, for biofuels, which have come up a lot today, that came into the tax law. It was supposed to cost $100 million. The paper companies discovered that by adding a little diesel fuel to a waste product from wood, they could run off from the Treasury with $1 billion, and it took Congress 3 years to repeal it. So we can't make these decisions in a political process. We need to make them in an engineering and scientific process and in an independent way. Politics is much too dependent on political contributions and political constituencies.
So look at the first 2 years plus now of President Obama's administration. Here he is, you know, after seven presidents who've tried and have not succeeded. He came in talking big. Look at his initiatives and how they've intersected with politics to leave us where we stand now.
Well, I think that he decided to go extremely large. I think the effort to enact a cap and trade, which would really transform the way we produce electricity in the United States, was a mistaken effort. That is, you know, it's interesting because Obama likes to talk about energy as if it's one subject, but our oil problem is really a problem of transportation fuels. That's where we use our oil.
You mean the liquid fuel that we need for cars and buses and so on?
Right. And we can use liquefied natural gas. There are natural gas buses and so forth. And we can use electricity to run some transportation, but that's a long way off in any important respect. The electricity sector, one of the successes we had since the 70s was we used to fuel 17% of our electricity with oil. Now we fuel less than 1%, but we're doing it through coal. And if you're worried about climate change, which is what Barack Obama was talking about when he first took the presidency, coal is a much bigger problem than oil. And so he tried to do everything at once. And then the other thing I think it's worth noting is that he really chose to make health a priority over energy. And so when he had control of the Congress, he used it on health, Obamacare, as it's now called, rather than on energy policy.
Are you saying he was wrong to go after cap and trade on its merits or wrong because it was politically too steep a hill to climb?
Well, I don't think the country was ready for it. Now, I think – well, let me be clear about this. I think that there are better alternatives to cap and trade. I think that imposing taxes on carbon emissions or on petroleum products or on gasoline, using the money in a way that it funds the cost. I mean, one of the problems that we've had since the 70s is we've never made these fuels pay for the costs that they impose on the public. We subsidize them by our military expenditures in the Middle East. We subsidize coal through not pricing its health costs and so forth. And we really need to put a price on the things that are bad in order for the things that are good to enter the market without the need for great subsidies and the like.
So treat it like a pack of cigarettes with all those taxes piled on top to discourage use? Is that what you're proposing?
Well, the tobacco story is actually a very good story in this respect. And you could impose a tax. It's the only good story, I might add, on this in this respect, the only successful story, but we've cut way back on our tobacco consumption. And you could impose a tax on things that we want to use less of, like gasoline and petroleum, and use the money to fund a reduction in taxes on things we want more of, like wages and jobs.
But Americans are already howling at $4 gasoline, you know, sometimes here.
Well, the problem is, of course, that you have to do this slow. If you're going to do it, you have to do it slowly. Jimmy Carter, for example, proposed a nickel a gallon increase in the gas tax in 1979. If we had just gone a nickel a year, we'd now be taxing gasoline at about $1.50 a gallon. We'd be using a lot less of it. And the problem with our $4 gas now is that the money is going to the Middle East. If you look at where the great capital exporting nations are today, it's not what they used to be. It's not the United States. It's not the United Kingdom. It's the petro countries along with China and Japan, which we know are supplying us capital. And so we're giving them money. They're using it to buy our assets through their sovereign wealth funds and the like, instead of taking the money and using it to lower taxes that we otherwise pay.
And now we've got real competitors on the green energy front in China galloping ahead, Germany galloping ahead. Let's get our listeners in here. Michael Gratz is with us. His new book is The End of Energy. Jeff is calling from Framingham, Massachusetts. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
And Mr. Gratz, I'm calling about two points. And one is that the oil is thought of as being imported oil from the Mideast. And yet the ones in the middle are American companies. Those companies are making lots and lots of money, and they are the ones who are drilling, bringing it in, and they are the ones who are standing in the way of not doing the oil import business. The most significant oil drilling here is in the Gulf by BP. I don't know what the connection with them is, but it's curious that we're going to again allow them to drill and maybe kill another 1,000 dolphins.
Well, we'll see where that goes. But Michael Gratz, what about you're blaming regional political interest for some of the gridlock here? It sounds like Jeff and a lot of our listeners, you know, have seen the big oil companies lobbying hard over years and lobbying for public opinion right now. You can turn on the evening news any night of the week, and it's, you know, oil. The more you know about it, the better it looks, or something like that. What about that direct lobby on American policy?
Well, you know, obviously the oil lobby is important. It's interesting that in the 2009 energy legislation, the coal lobby outmuscled dramatically the oil lobby and the natural gas lobby. And so they did much better in the House bill than oil and gas. But let me make a point about history here, Tom, because it's very important given our situation in Libya today. And that is that in 1969, when Gaddafi took over Libya, he basically threw the oil companies out, and he transformed the relationship of the oil companies in the Mideast from being a owner. The oil companies, the Seven Sisters, five of which were U.S. companies, owned the oil under the ground in the Middle East until the 1970s. By the time the transformation of the 70s took place, they were now serving, which they do, as technological specialist marketers, salespeople, deliverers.
Mm-hmm.
And the oil is owned, and the prices are set, and the supply spigot is turned on and off by the nations of the Middle East. And we know that our choices to go into Iraq and to go into Libya are not accidental. To go into Kuwait in 1990, we've been a hostage. Foreign policy has been a hostage to control of oil in the Middle East for 40 years now. And so I think we can talk about the power of the oil companies in the American political system, and it's very important. But we also need to talk about the power of the control of oil by partners that are less reliable than we would like.
But that's just what everyone's trying to get away from, and yet after all these presidents and their terms and their statements, here we still are. Let me get Ricky on, if I may, Willisburg, Kentucky. Ricky, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, what do you see?
Well, to me, I think one of the biggest problems with the United States is that the lobbyists are giving money for their best interest to Senate and Congress, and we got too many crooks in the United States running our government, and we're no better off than Libya or Egypt. And till we change that, there's never going to be a change here in the United States, because the interest of the government is in the hands of Congress and the Senate and the President, and their best interest is for them themselves lining their pockets instead of taking care of the people here in the United States. They're more set to go overseas and give money to people and give them food and everything. When we, as a nation, have people here in the United States sleeping in cardboard boxes on the street, tents, they have nothing.
Ricky, we've got it. I appreciate your perspective right there. Michael Gratz, everybody has seen how alternative energy industries have grown rapidly overseas. I mean, China, you know, you pointed out, we were solar energy leaders. Now China, very strong on that front. Germany, with an economy a fraction the size of ours, you know, sort of has surpassed us in clean energy spending now. And they're a much smaller economy than the U.S. economy. Our caller looks at lobbyists in Washington and sees us bound up right there. But isn't anybody looking for the big picture here?
Well, I think that's the problem. That was why I really decided to write a book that was about energy policy and our energy history writ large, because people tend to look at these in silos, and they look at one aspect of it. So the solar folks are interested in solar and so forth. I do want to say something about Ricky's comments about money and politics, because I'm very much with him on the grounds that we've got way too much money in the American political system. But the First Amendment and the interpretations of it recently by the Supreme Court mean that we're not going to get it out of the political system. But I think it's a mistake, again, to blame money and to blame partisanship on this. When Tom Coburn is worried about oil drilling in Oklahoma, sure, he's worried about the oil companies, but he's also worried about jobs in Oklahoma. Chuck Grassley is interested in the refinery jobs and the agriculture jobs for ethanol. Jay Rockefeller is interested in coal producers, but he's also interested in coal workers. And the people who are supporting low electricity prices are worried about people throwing them out of office because they're going to raise their prices on electricity or gasoline.
So you're saying democracy is the problem. Representing the local interests, as they're supposed to do, ends up being the problem?
Well, I'm not saying democracy is the problem.
Well,
I'm saying that we do need to find ways to reorganize the way in which Congress deals with these issues. So instead of having each committee deal parochially with its piece of the energy puzzle, we really need to come up with some new institutional arrangements to try and deal with these. But there's no question that the contests regionally are going to keep being a problem.
Michael Gratz is with us from New York. His new book is The End of Energy, The Unmaking of America's Environment, Security, and Independence. There's an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. And we're joined as well right now from Washington by Stephen Mufsen, energy correspondent for The Washington Post. Stephen, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
I wish you'd walk us in more detail again through some of what the president is laying out this time. And then I want to get you and Michael Gratz to look at the politics around the pieces of this, what's likely and what's not. We've learned from experience that just because President Obama or any president proposes something doesn't mean it happens. Cap and trade went down big time. But what looks to you like the most important pieces of what the president's laying out here just this last week again, Stephen?
Well, I think the pieces, in fact, are not as important as some of the things he's done in the past. The pieces are and I think the rhetoric is big, but in fact the goals are not overwhelming. I mean, the big news, I think, was this idea that we could cut oil imports by a third by the year 2025.
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty long period of time, and it seems like it should be doable in some ways, although obviously over time our pattern has been to have increasing consumption of oil, all of it pretty much, or more than two-thirds of it going into our vehicles. The components that he raised were to do more with biofuels, to have more exploration domestically and boost domestic production, which is hard since the trend line there has until recently been downward, and to do more with the fuel efficiency of heavy trucks.
So this doesn't sound like hyper-ambitious stuff, and we've got listeners responding and saying, here's one online saying, even if we drilled in Anwar in the Gulf of Mexico, the shores of Florida, California, everywhere possible in this country, we would not produce enough oil to supply our needs. Is that true?
Well, yes, and that's why he's not calling for energy independence. He's calling for a reduction in our dependence, but there will still be dependence on imports in 2025, no doubt about it.
So
the other component he had was to promote more use of natural gas, and especially in fleets of vehicles like city buses.
So just as
better than doing it for passenger vehicles, because you don't have to renovate every gas station in America. The fleets, rely on a smaller number of depots.
A lot of critics have come in and said this is not exactly a revolutionary energy policy. This looks more like a pragmatic political strategy here, that you scratch the back of oil producing states, you scratch the back of natural gas producing states, there's more on clean coal in here. Is this more about energy or about politics, Stephen?
It's partly about energy, but it's largely about politics. He is looking for things that are doable. There's no question about it. This is not a Richard Nixon or Jimmy Carter style call for sacrifice. He's not asking us to drive slower. He's not proposing higher taxes. He's not suggesting you turn down your thermostat and put on a sweater. None of that. This is all about making ourselves more efficient, and there's no real sacrifice in this equation.
Do you see a plan that's likely to come to fruition? He had some big plans when he was on the campaign trail. A lot of that fell off the wagon. Do you see this as doable, as modest as its goals may be?
Yeah, I think so, because I think there is a big constituency out there to promote more use of natural gas. The states that are closest to offshore drilling areas, a lot of them are inclined to do more of it. So it's not a layup, but it could be doable.
Michael Gretz, do you see then a president here who's lining goals up with politics, not setting them in opposition to politics? Does that get us to the energy future that we need, Michael?
Well, I don't think it will get us to the energy future we need. I think the really interesting thing about this speech compared to his other speeches and ideas is that this time he is really focused on things that the executive branch and the president has control over. So he's talking about leasing of federal lands. He's talking about government purchasing policies for biofuel and electric vehicles, jet fuel for the Defense Department. He's talking about changing the fuel efficiency standards under the automobile fuel efficiency law that was passed in the mid-70s and extending it to trucks, which he has authority mm-hmm. to do under existing law. And so I think he now understands that he can do a lot of things himself through the executive power, and he doesn't need Congress. And what he needs Congress for, I agree with Steve entirely, what he needs Congress for are those kinds of things where he's throwing political plums around to all sorts of constituencies and describing in general terms tough choices, but as Stephen said, not laying any of them out to the American people.
Stephen Mupson, what about that? He can do it with executive authority, but yet we've seen on the EPA front where he's, the courts have ruled and he's asked the EPA to go after carbon emissions in power generation. There's been a huge pushback from Congress on that. Is it clear that the president can really do this without somehow getting the politics lined up for significant action?
Well, I think on fuel efficiency, and for that matter on carbon emissions, I think the president's authority is pretty clear. I think the most important thing he's done and probably will ever do during his presidency on reducing oil imports was the thing he did relatively early in his administration by negotiating an agreement with auto companies and unions and what have you to increase the fuel efficiency of American vehicles. There's nothing more important than that for reducing our oil imports. So, and that was within his authority. The EPA issue is a little different, but actually if you go back and read the Supreme Court decision that was handed down April 1st of 2007, it makes clear that that EPA has the authority to regulate CO2 emissions. So that's a little trickier because we're getting a big backlash in Congress over this issue. But I think that EPA, and, you know, it seems to me pretty clear reading the opinion. I mean, I'm not a lawyer, but it seems pretty darn clear that they have that authority.
But is the EPA standing firm on that under the political heat? Are they still intending to fully exercise that authority as the president outlined earlier? Or it has seemed as though some of their comments as though they're backing off.
I think they do not want to show down on this issue, and especially since it's possible that there might be enough votes to handcuff some of their funding to this issue. I mean, I think the president would veto any bill that tried to curtail EPA's authority, but I don't think he or the EPA really want to go down this road if they can avoid it. I mean, I think for them, the ideal outcome would be to negotiate with utilities the way the president did with car makers, and for it never to be an issue in Congress. But they don't seem quite there on the utility side right now.
Which means it could be authority, but not real power. Betsy in Burlington, Vermont, you're on the air, Betsy. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I just watched a film last night called Journey to Planet Earth with Lester Brown. He's talking about the need to cut our greenhouse gas emissions by 80% by the year 2020 to save civilization. He's worked on these things for decades, and he's talking about, you know, switching to clean energy, solar, wind, geothermal, with the same kind of mobilization that FDR used in World War II when he switched the auto plants over to making armaments.
Yeah, Betsy, you remind us of the urgency here. And let me put it to Michael and Stephen. I mean, whether or not, with what the president's outlining, with what he's pushing for now, goals that seem relatively modest, I mean, are we on a track? There's Lester Brown, environmentalist, founder of World Watch. He's saying, you know, we need to cut fossil fuel consumption by 80% by 2020. That's sort of day after tomorrow in energy terms. Are we lined up? I'll come first to you, Stephen. Are we lined up with, you know, a real sense of the urgency of the need here when it comes to carbon?
Well, I think that if you believe the forecasts of climate scientists, even if you think they're off by a magnet, you know, by 50%, the targets that one would need to reach by the year 2050 are incredibly daunting. It's just very hard to see how we're going to get there. Just technologically, economically, or politically.
Michael Gratz, this doesn't seem acceptable to be so far off of, you know, the target that a whole lot of people are clamoring we need to be really focused on right now.
Well, I think the president has really taken a beating on his view of climate change and the greenhouse gas problem. He didn't focus on that in his speech. He focused on energy security, oil imports, and the like. The Republicans in the Congress have really pushed back hard. They've used a few emails and a couple of sentences and very, very voluminous scientific information to confuse the public about the science here. There are some very, very serious risks that we're taking with greenhouse gas emissions. And what are we doing? Well, look at our economy. You ask, where is the great growth in exports at the moment? Well, we're exporting our coal to China. We're exporting huge amounts of coal to China. And this is one of the bright spots in the economy, supposedly. Well, it may be a bright spot in the trade balance, but it's a very dark spot if one is concerned about climate change, because that's a global phenomenon, and it doesn't help us. It may help people's health for us to burn natural gas instead of coal here. But it doesn't help the climate change problem if we simply relocate coal-fired plants to China and India.
So what's the lesson then for this president who came in talking big, if he's to learn from the seven presidents before him who sort of tried and failed on a number of fronts here? I mean, is there a way that you can see, looking at this history, Michael Gratz, surely it's not enough for the president just to tamp down expectations and kind of stop talking about problems that climate scientists are talking about very loudly. Surely that's not a way to solve the problem people are very aware we're facing. Is there a lesson from the presidents before him that might be helpful here?
Well, I think he's really made a decision in the first term, as I mentioned earlier, to focus on health rather than energy. And in that sense, I think he lost a whole lot of ground on the climate change problem in particular, and is left to dealing with these other energy problems at the level that he can do in the executive branch himself. So I have to say I'm really not optimistic. I close my book by saying that while knowing our history is important, it may not prevent us from repeating it. And if you think about this, Tom, we're right at the midpoint between 1970 and 2050. And 2050 is the key moment when climate change really becomes extremely dangerous for us. And there's very little that you can hang on to that would make you optimistic that we're really going to transform the economy, except, as you mentioned earlier in the hour, the prospect of technological breakthroughs in reducing the cost, particularly of things like solar energy and the like. But it's very hard to look at this 40-year history and be sanguine about solving these problems going forward.
A lot of people looking north over the border into Canada, looking for energy solutions for the United States there on a large scale. Let's get a call from Hemingford in Quebec in Canada. Luis is on the line. Hi, Luis. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, hello, Mr. Well, good program.
Thank you.
I'm wondering, you talk about the Saudi oil, but in Canada, we are a major supplier to the U.S. And with the oil sand project in Alberta, and there are lots of American companies involved in these projects. I was wondering if Obama, with his environmental rhetoric, will overlook the oil sand exploration in Alberta.
Tar sands in Alberta, and, of course, big plans there, big pipeline debate right now over whether to have that big funnel coming right down through the U.S. Stephen Mufson, what about Canadian oil? Is that part of what President Obama wants to get off of when he talks about reducing oil imports by a third? Does he just consider that part of the home team, North American, homegrown somehow? And what about the fact that it's tar sands oil, not light, sweet crude out of Saudi?
Well, there is a certain irony about the discussion about getting off of imports because our leading sources are Canada and Mexico, with Saudi Arabia not too far behind. So it's but of course the issue about imports isn't just where the imports come from, but at the price at which they would be. And
well, and the source, tar sands is not a lot of people are worried about the production that goes into tar sands.
Right. So when you're talking about tar sands, it's a problem because it uses a lot more. There's a lot of energy used to basically melt this stuff and turn it into oil, and it takes a lot of water. They're become more efficient than they used to be in those operations, but they're still comparable to the dirtiest oil we get from Venezuela, which is really not great for the environment. So it's not if you're worried about climate, this isn't really the answer.
Michael Gratz, I don't know. We're looking for some hopeful last word from you. I don't know if you've got it looking back on all these years. If there's one word to the wise you could give President Obama with the time he's got, with the power he's got, what would it be?
Natural gas. I have to say I think that we could really make a lot of progress by relying more heavily on natural gas. There's now huge discoveries of natural gas throughout the country. Ranging from the East Coast down to Texas.
That's the best we've got. It's still carbon-based.
It's much healthier than coal. It emits half of the carbon greenhouse gases of coal. You've got to make progress where you can as soon as you can, because the carbon problem and the climate change problem is a cumulative problem. And so every day we wait, we're taking risks.
Some of what this president is up against, in line with many presidents before him, and boy, I don't hear a silver bullet in that conversation, but we're going to stay abreast no matter what. People want progress here, one way or another. Michael Gratz's new book is The End of Energy. He joined us today from New York City. Michael Gratz, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
And Stephen Mufson with The Washington Post. Thanks for joining us from D.C., Stephen.
My pleasure, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for being here. Good luck to us all. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.